Pseudopod number 13, November 24th, 2006. Today's story, Redmond's Private Screening by Kevin J. Anderson. Welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast magazine. I'm your host, co-editor Mer Lafferty, who along with Ben Phillips strive to bring you the best in horror audio. We've noticed that with The Grudge and The Ring and its many sequels, the Japanese horror is a big hit over here. One of our more popular stories has been Yuji Foster's Returning My Sister's Face, so even in short stories we can see that it's true. Which is good, because this week we bring you another story about something scary from the land of the rising sun. Our story this week is Redmond's Private Screening by Kevin J. Anderson. Mr. Anderson is a Nebula Award-nominated author who has written books in the Star Wars universe, the Doom universe, the X-Files universe, the StarCraft universe, and several original books, including the Saga of the Seven Suns series. He recently came out with book 5 of the Saga of the Seven Suns, called Of Fire and Night. The story is read to us by Scott Sigler, a popular podcast novelist, who is currently reading his fourth novel, The Rookie, found at scottsigler.net. Now get your popcorn and your 3D glasses, but check that dangerous racism at the door.
Redmond's Private Screening by Kevin J. Anderson. Sharper than any barber's straight razor, the edge of the samurai blade nicked the skin, drew blood. The director hissed in surprise, frowning at his cut finger, then laughed at himself. "How'd you like to slice that across your belly, Mikey?" As his assistant, Michael Kendai, watched, Redmond held the blade up to the bright California sunlight that streamed into the makeshift studio through open windows and a cobweb skylight.
"The katana is real, sir, a century old, more than just a prop.
Forged in 1811, eh?" He didn't sound impressed. "It's just a sword." Outside, the muffled sounds of motor car traffic echoed along the dirt streets. One of the rattling vehicles backfired, and someone shouted obscenities in coarse Italian. Horses clopped by, pulling a late morning milk cart. In his tiny warehouse studio, Michael knew that Redmond never noticed any outside distractions. He was too caught up in finding interesting things to shoot with his motion picture camera, and he would never believe the doomsayers who claimed that Nickelodeon audiences were tired of seeing Marvels on celluloid film.
"Where'd you get this samurai Taka what's-his-name?"
Redmond spoke as if the young Japanese man and his elderly parents weren't already right there beside him. The immigrants spoke no English, remained apart from the conversation, but they knew full well the business matters being discussed.
"And how did you talk him into doing Harry Carey in front of the motion picture camera?"
Michael folded his hands together, frowned at Redmond's unkempt appearance, must red-brown hair, and pungent cologne. He gave the director a look that plainly said, "Not many people try my patience, but you are one of them."
"Akira Takahashi came to me of his own free will and volunteered his performance of Harikari."
He looked around the small backroom studio, not eager to begin, but they would lose the best sunlight soon. The glass cyclopean eye of his hand-cranked movie camera stood watching the young samurai. A spare camera, which didn't work anyway, leaned against a corner. Takahashi sat in bright robes, cross-legged on the white blanket he had spread out for him on top of the sour sawdust. His pate had been shaved in the traditional fashion, his straight black hair gathered in a ponytail at his neck. The old father, holding a worn, nicked sword of his own, squatted stony-faced beside his son, staring straight ahead. Only the wrinkled mother showed fear and anger, flashing tears at Redmond. Michael explained,
"Mr. Takahashi wishes to book steamer passage back to Japan for his parents, and he can think of no other way to raise the money. He considers it a fair exchange."
Redmond laughed nervously. His face had too many freckles. His skin was too pasty. His personality too slippery.
"A lot of people are trying to get into this new movie business, but not usually by killing themselves on film."
He sheathed the blade and handed the slim katana back. Michael frowned at how low he himself had fallen, how disappointed the spirits of his own dead family must be.
Most directors do not wish to photograph such a spectacle either, and most patrons do not wish to see the result, but there are exceptions everywhere.
He gave Redman a cold stare.
You and I know how to find them.
The director raised his chin, pontificating.
You know, 15 years ago, people flocked to Nickelodeons to see a man sneeze, to watch a waterfall or running horse. Today, we gotta give him something more for the money, eh?
I'm sure you do.
With a deaf ear for his assistant's sarcasm, Redman strutted around the floor, looking at the natural light, at the position of the white blanket, but Michael had already set up everything perfectly. The three Japanese followed the director with their eyes, like animals in a cage.
If they liked it so much in Japan, why'd they come to Hollywood in the first place, eh?
Redman whispered, as if he didn't want the family to hear. Michael drew a deep breath.
Many well-to-do samurai families were ruined in the overthrow of the last shogun in 1868. Akita's father tried to earn a living in the new Japanese National Army, but he could not tolerate the army's lack of traditional honor. His eldest son, Akita's brother, entered the Japanese Navy and was killed 5 years ago in the Russo-Japanese War. Akita and his parents then fled to America, but they found no opportunities here. Now they are destitute and wish only to go home and die.
Well, we'll help him out then, eh?
Redman removed a folded piece of paper from his trouser pocket.
I drew up a simple contract for Mr. Samurai. Get him to sign it, and then we can start shooting.
He looked critically at the slanting daylight in the studio.
Read it to him if you like.
Michael glanced over the contract. It looked as if Redman had done the typing himself. He formally presented the samurai with his sword, then spoke rapidly in Japanese, explaining the contract and its purpose. The young man drew himself up, glared at Redman, and answered Michael sharply.
He doesn't understand the need for a contract.
Michael turned to Redman.
He asks if you are questioning his honor, if you doubt he will do as he has promised.
What?
Redman was oblivious to nuances.
The contract's for his protection, not mine.
Michael relayed the information. The old mother spoke quickly, while her son stared down at the curved sword in its sheath.
They ask why they should not trust you. Are you not an honorable man?
Redman made an exasperated sound.
Oh, God. Mikey, just explain to them I need to have it in writing that he's fully aware of what he's doing, that he offered his services willingly, and that I did not seek him out. What does he care anyway? He's going to be dead.
Michael considered it for a moment, then spoke in Japanese again.
I told him it was our custom to require such arrangements. They have a great respect for customs and traditions.
Finally, Takahashi took the contract and signed. Redman rolled his eyes and tucked the signed paper into his pocket. He clapped his hands for attention.
Okay, all right, let's get this show on the road.
Michael took up his position behind the tripod, checking the lens, making sure the celluloid reel was loaded properly. Due to the questionable legality of his projects, Redman involved as few people in the productions as possible. Michael had become accustomed to cranking the camera himself. Sunlight poured through the fly-speck skylight, flooding the blanket spread on the floor. Akira Takahashi blinked in the glare. The handle of the katana looked like molten silver. Redman didn't have to tell anyone what to do. The old mother moved out of the light to where she could watch. The elder Takahashi drew himself taller, holding his own sword in one hand. He waited just behind and to the right of his son.
Mikey, what's the old guy doing with a sword?
Redman asked.
He is the kaishaku.
Michael paused long enough to emphasize how little Redman understood about what was going to take place.
During harikari, a samurai is permitted to have a close friend stand beside him. Once he has succeeded in cutting open his belly, the friend is allowed to strike off his head, releasing him from terrible pain.
Redman's eyes widened.
You mean the old man is going to chop up? Oh, fantastic! You didn't tell me that before!
Michael scowled, then erased the expression. By participating in this heinous act, he felt as if he was betraying the Takahashi family, but he was giving them what they wanted. even with his rationalizations. He disgusted himself. Michael looked through the camera and signaled to Takahashi that everything was ready. The young samurai held the gazes of his parents for a long moment. Then he took up the sword. Michael began to turn the crank, recording every second on the clicking ribbon of film. Takahashi pulled the katana from its sheath, never taking his eyes from the steel. The traditional samurai sword had been crafted by one of the finest Zen sword makers, displaying an edge that consisted of 500,000 layers of folded steel, so sharp it seemed to slice rays of sunlight. Takahashi took a white cloth from his father and wrapped it around the blade close to the hilt, leaving 5 inches of naked metal. He placed the wrapped katana on the blanket in front of him so he could proceed without taking his eyes from it. He never blinked while he undid the sash of his ceremonial robe, baring his chest. His stomach muscles were firm and tense. Maintaining an even, smooth motion, Michael turned the camera crank as queasiness built within him. If a blade had plunged into his own belly, a swarm of butterflies would have emerged. Takahashi stared into space. Moving by itself, his hand picked up the katana again, flipped it around so that its point rested against his abdomen. Michael saw the smallest of tremors in his throat, as if he were trying not to swallow. For long moments, he did not breathe. Everything stopped, like a still from a motion picture. The father stood like a statue behind his son, sword raised and waiting. The ancient mother stared wide-eyed, but made no sound. Redmond fidgeted.
What's he waiting for?
Shut up, Redmond.
Takahashi uttered an animal sound and thrust 5 inches of blade into the left side of his abdomen. He made an astonished coughing sound. He sat rigid, frozen again. Crimson soaked into his bright robe, dribbled onto his leg. Spasms flickered across his face, betraying the pain. Takahashi's hands became slippery with blood, but he managed to keep his grip on the handle. He used both hands against the back of the blade to push the cutting edge across his stomach in a gash that grew wider like a grotesque smile. His face turned gray and wet, and his breathing had no rhythm at all. Michael continued to turn the camera crank. Redmond stared, silent with awe and fascination. Takahashi's body shuddered as the blade cut below his navel. He gave another, weaker cry, and wrenched the blade the rest of the way across. Michael's world turned red and fuzzy. Black things swam in his stomach and his eyes. Sweat trickled down his forehead. His knees turned to water, but at least he didn't topple the camera. Redmond saw him faint, muttered a curse, and pushed him out of the way. He began cranking the camera himself. Takahashi's body convulsed as if he were trying to vomit, and intestines spilled into his lap like gray, white, and red eels. His eyes pushed away their glassy bleariness and widened upon seeing all that had been kept neatly inside him. He made a gurgling sound.
"Seppuku!"
the old man cried, and brought down his sword, striking off his son's head. The dead samurai collapsed into a heap of blood and mismatched flesh. The old man fell to his knees.
"Perfect!"
Redmond said, and stopped filming. Two days later, Michael found Redmond waiting for him in a booth at the back of the cafe, adding too much sugar to his mug of coffee. Michael felt bone-weary and ragged.
"The funeral pyre was very difficult to arrange, Redmond."
The director scowled up from his plate of fried eggs.
"I don't care how hard it was, Mikey. You're not getting any more money for it. We got a written agreement."
Michael let out a disgusted sigh as he sat down.
"I was merely stating a fact."
Seeing Michael's Japanese features, the waiter ignored him. Redmond stirred his coffee, oblivious to how his spoon clanged against the mug. He whistled for the waiter to bring coffee for Michael.
"So why did you go to all that trouble if it was so difficult? That part wasn't even written into the contract."
The waiter brought a silver pot over, then left scowling when Michael ordered tea instead.
Redman, we killed their son. We owed it to them.
What is someone with a conscience doing in this business?
Redman tried to laugh, then took a bite out of his jam-smeared toast.
Besides, we didn't kill the guy. If his parents didn't want him to do it, they could have stopped him at any time.
He slurped his coffee, then spooned in more sugar.
Not in Japanese culture, Redman. Once a son comes of age, the parents must follow his wishes. Mr. Takahashi decided to send his mother and father home. They had no choice in the matter.
The waiter returned with Michael's tea. Absently, after the man had left, he took a sugar cube and laid it on his saucer, crushing it with the rounded bottom of his spoon, then tapped the sugar into his tea.
Their steamer should have departed for Japan at dawn today.
You haven't heard yet, eh?
Redman snickered, another bite of toast poised halfway to his mouth.
The old man was so excited that he dropped stone dead on the deck, spilled Junior's ashes all over the place. Can you imagine the expression on the old lady's face?
Michael stopped stirring his tea and looked straight into Redman's muddy green eyes, searching for some sign of a practical joke.
How do you know this? Why did no one tell me?
Because no one could find you. As far as I know, you disappeared off the face of the earth when you don't want to be found. I got a telegram from a frustrated delivery boy. Seems he'd been running all over Hollywood looking for you.
Michael remained silent for so long that Redman began to fidget. The family had already been through so much. Michael finally muttered, as if speaking to himself.
The eldest son died fighting the Russian Navy for Liaotung Peninsula. On his last birthday, after he'd been gone for months on the battleship Miyako, the family set out an extra bowl of rice to honor him. And the son sent his spirit across the sea to join them for the meal. They laughed and talked, but with moonrise, the spirit returned to the ship.
He lowered his voice to a whisper.
That night, the Miyako struck a mine in the Sea of Japan and sank.
Redman took another bite of his runny eggs.
You mean the ghost appeared even before the son was killed? Just what were they doing for the little celebration, smoking opium pipes?
Opium is from China, Redman, not Japan.
With an effort, Michael regained his patience.
Vengeful ghosts are common in our tradition. Anyone who dies violently is certain to haunt those who caused him to suffer. But the Japanese don't believe a person needs to be dead to send his spirit wandering. The family Takahashi truly believes they dined with the elder son on the eve of his death.
Aw, tug my heartstrings.
Then Redman narrowed his eyes at Michael.
Oh, I see. You're trying to scare me. The Mr. Samurai's ghost is coming to get me. Forget it, Mikey. He volunteered. You brought him to me.
Michael didn't bother to respond. He stood up, leaving Redman to pay for his unfinished tea.
Is that all you wanted to see me about?
Redman smiled.
I'll be screening my samurai picture in 3 days, and I need you to run the projector. I found a private room and 5 men sufficiently bored with the Nickelodeons. They'll pay $10 each if I can deliver what I promised. Some are worried it might be trick photography, like George Méliès used to do.
Méliès never showed a man disemboweling himself.
Michael let no ironic expression show.
Besides, Redman, who could question your honesty?
Redman grinned, then scowled, then drank his coffee. Redman insisted on keeping the door locked and the screening room dim, lit only by tasteless red lights behind incense burners. Even more tasteless was his decision to use Takashi's white blanket, laundered to remove most of the bloodstains, as a projection screen. Michael mounted the single celluloid reel on the projector as Redman ushered his clients to flimsy wooden chairs in the room. The director wore a ridiculous Japanese robe, as if to create the proper ambiance. Michael inspected the 5 men, who didn't bother to notice the Japanese-American assistant. One looked bored, 2 were fidgety, wearing obvious disguises. The remaining 2 frowned with skepticism while tugging on their identical mutton chop whiskers. Michael wondered what type of lives these men led. Did they beat their wives, or harm their children, or frequent prostitutes? Or did they derive enough pleasure just from watching gruesome motion picture shows? Of the 6 pictures on which he had worked with Redman, this had been by far the most dissatisfying. The first had been a beautiful study of a ballerina's dance. Then he had photographed sultry, naked women. What might come next after ritual suicide? Redmond killing a baby, perhaps? Michael felt the shame in his involvement, even if Redmond didn't care. After this evening spectacle, Michael had made up his mind to disappear, as he had done so many times before, simply cover his tracks. He had enough skill and connections to find work elsewhere, even with his Japanese heritage. Perhaps he would go to New York, though the majority of filmmaking had shifted towards the Los Angeles area with its variety of scenery. As Michael felled the celluloid film into the projector and checked the bulb, Redmond began to explain, inaccurately, the traditions and lore behind Harikari. Michael considered leaving the room after he started the projector, just to avoid seeing Takahashi die yet again. But he decided against it. He would see this project through to the end, then be away from Redmond for good.
"Gentlemen, please enjoy the first screening of Redmond's Scarlet Sword."
The director placed his hands together to imitate a Japanese bow, then stepped away from the bloodstained screen. As the projector began to flicker and whir, a sepia image of Akira Takahashi appeared on the screen. Michael focused quickly. The five men in the audience watched as the grim young man sat cross-legged in his robes, staring at his sword. The film was intensely sharp and remarkably clear, showing too many details. Takahashi withdrew the katana from its sheath and took the cloth from his father's gnarled hand. The clicking projector made the only noise in the room. The men leaned forward to watch. Michael was reminded of crocodiles lurking on riverbanks, alert for prey. Takahashi placed the point of the sword against his stomach. He drew a deep breath, ready for the thrust. Along the top of the screen appeared a deep crimson line, startling in its intensity against the black and white world. The red line widened, covering about a quarter of the screen, before it began to drip like thick blood down the screen. The five men muttered in amazement at Redmond's technique, how he'd been able to superimpose such a brilliant color on the dull sepia tone.
"Mikey,"
Redmond said, his voice a confused growl. On the image, Takahashi stared down at the curved sword, oblivious to the thick red streams oozing across the screen and obliterating everything. Feeling a growing horror, Michael tapped the projector lens. A shadow of his fingers should have fallen across the stained blanket screen, but it didn't. Droplets popped out of the movie reel itself, like juice from a pomegranate seed. Michael touched the film feeding into the projector. His fingers came away wet and sticky. The five men in the audience began to grumble. The crimson blot prevented them from seeing what the samurai was doing. Redmond swallowed several times. His freckled skin looked a sick gray in the red light. The curtain of blood spilled to the bottom of the screen and covered the entire picture. A roaring wind numbed Michael's ears, making him giddy. His vision went fuzzy, and then an empty coldness swept over him. The wind stopped abruptly, and a surreal fuzziness filled the screening room.
"Mikey!"
Redmond's voice cracked like a pubescent teenager's. The projector had stopped, though the screen still glowed like a window onto a scarlet landscape. Michael stood beside the motionless reel of film, but he could not move. Neither did the men seated in the wooden folding chairs. It was as if time had stopped, as if the apparatus projecting their lives had frozen on a single frame. Except for Redmond, who stormed back and forth.
"What the hell is going on here?"
He seemed to know the answer, but could think of nothing else to say, no other way to pretend having command of the situation.
"Will vengeance suffice?"
It wasn't a voice. It wasn't even words. Michael heard Japanese, but the other men in the room seemed to understand as well. Redmond made a strange sound between a gulp and a scream.
"What do you mean? I did everything I promised!"
He paused, as if spinning through his memories of everything Michael had told him.
"I kept my honor!"
Michael could not react, or move, or say anything to help him.
"You are a man fundamentally without honor, writing promises on paper to ensure that you will keep them, profiting by the suffering of others. These five will receive enough blood for their tastes and my own. Such men deserve to die as common criminals.
The men sat frozen in their seats, but Michael watched as their heads slumped, one by one. He thought he heard a squelching sound and then a haunting series of screams echoing in the air. Michael felt like a helpless bystander, watching and wondering if he himself might be next.
Redmond, you shall have an opportunity to regain your honor.
The crimson screen covering the screen thinned and began to drip away, revealing a new image of a freckled man dressed in gaudy Japanese robes. He sat cross-legged and holding a samurai sword against his bared abdomen.
You can't do this!
In the room, Redmond swatted at his robe as if trying to knock away the touch of a phantom sword. The image of Redmond on the screen sat contemplating the blade about to pierce his stomach.
We had a contract!
I made no contract with you.
Yes, you signed it, and I fulfilled my part just like I promised. I didn't cheat you. Look, I'm sorry your father died, but I had nothing to do with that. I can't help it. He spilled your ashes in the dock. Please!
Michael tried to call out to Redmond, but his vocal cords had snapped like so many spider webs.
You have confused me with my son, fool. He is content with the bargain he made and with the price it cost him. I am the one who demands vengeance.
On the screen, another robed figure stepped behind the image of Redmond, holding a second sword. Takahashi's old mother, taking up her position to be Redmond's kaishaku.
I am the one that suffered most. My sons are both gone. My husband, I am left with nothing, and I demand retribution.
You can't be a ghost. You're not even dead.
On the screen, the old woman smiled and raised the sword.
Why must a body be dead for the spirit to roam free?
She nodded to the image of Redmond in the film. He looked into space as if in a trance, then drove the sword into his belly. The film broke, and the projector bulb burst at the same time. Michael snapped off the machine, and as silence returned, he heard a brief remnant of a scream disappearing into time. It sounded like Redmond's voice. He fumbled for the main light switches. Redmond sprawled on the floor, clutching his stomach. The other five men slumped in their folding wooden chairs, arms dangling at their sides. Michael touched Redmond. The director's skin was cold and rigid. He checked the businessmen, and they were dead as well. He could find no blood anywhere. The sticky redness had vanished even from the film and the projector. The shock crept up on him, paralyzing him. Why had the old woman's ghost spared him? He himself had arranged for her son's death. But Michael had not deviated from the old woman's conception of honor, as Redmond had. That did not mean Michael was an honorable man. He still had to deal with his own shame. Shame. The traditions of Michael Kendai's culture had taught him how to cope with shame. Was the old woman's ghost expecting him to follow the traditional course? Redmond had the excuse of ignorance. Michael did not. Would she come after him if he didn't kill himself to atone for his crime? But he was too much of a coward. He rewound the film before he removed the reel. He vowed that no one else would ever watch Scarlet Sword. He would destroy it. He knew where Redmond kept prints of his other films, and he mounted the ballerina reel onto the projector. The police would be very confused. Michael would be long gone before anyone discovered the bodies and turned their eyes towards a convenient Japanese scapegoat. Michael could cover his tracks. He was good at that. New York looked better and better. Fighting down the feelings of fear and shame within him, Michael left the screening room. He tried to keep from running as he fled into the street.
I know we're all about the horror here, but I have to admit that with some stories, I just love it when the bad guy gets his bloody, terrified comeuppance. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is produced under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 2.5 license And did you know you could get a t-shirt with all of that on it? The music you hear in the background is by Anders Manga at andersmanga.com. Pseudopod consists of co-editors Mer Lafferty and Ben Phillips and publisher Steve Ely. We're a paying market. There's a donation button on the website. And if you can't find it in your pockets to give, at least spread the word about Pseudopod if you have friends that you think would like to be scared as well. Tune in next week for a new scary story. And until then, you might want to get your movies from an online service because the ghosts can't get you if you use Netflix. Thanks for listening!